This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Baseball was one of the activities that helped restore normalcy after World War II. Certainly true in eastern North Carolina. Starting in 1946, the Tobacco State League pitted teams including the Rockingham Eagles and the Lumberton Auctioneers against one another to the delight of thousands of fans. That league didn't last long, only five summers, but the memories of those dusty ball fields live on in a new book. The Tobacco State League in North Carolina Baseball History paints a picture of the teams and the towns that took a swing at baseball greatness. Author Chris Holliday is here with me now to tell us more about it. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in this?
Just the history of it and telling the stories that weren't told anywhere else. And I grew up in Texas in a big league town. Then when I came to college at UNC, friends took me to a Durham Bulls game, and I realized there was so much history that wasn't really recorded anywhere else at that time. So I just started researching it, and more stories started coming out, and that led to a book project.
Well, tell us about this period, because it's an interesting time in baseball. I mean, there's a real distinction between semi-pro and minor league baseball. Maybe you could make that distinction for us to give us the landscape of all those people who were playing baseball but not in the majors.
Semi-pro baseball didn't really follow organized rules. I mean, it was just like if you had the money and you could pay some guys, then that was whatever you could afford, I guess. Professional baseball, which included all the minor leagues and the major leagues, they're all governed by one organization, and that began in 1902. And so the Tobacco State League, this league, started out as a semi-pro league before the war, and it was mainly for college players who just played for the summers. And then after the war, I guess town leaders decided they wanted to, like, take the next step and go pro. And so they joined the National Association, which was the governing body, you know, followed the rules. They're the salary cap rules they had, and these changed constantly. And so they were governed, and they were an official professional league.
It's interesting to think about that even back then. I mean, these rules about salary caps and how many players you could have who had been at one time in the major leagues and all that were strict rules going back to 1902. And now here they are. So tell us about this league. How many teams do we have at its peak?
It started out as six, and then it went up to eight, and they varied. I mean, I think the only teams that were in it every year were Wilmington and Sanford.
Yeah.
A couple of them, like Fayetteville, was only in there 1 year in 47, and then they moved actually to a bigger league. So it changed a lot.
Big appetite after World War II, obviously.
It was. I mean, there were so many players coming back from military service, players who'd been promising baseball players before the war and had their careers interrupted. And then they got back, they were kind of too old to be major league prospects. So if they could sign on with a small town team, maybe in their own hometown even, get paid for it, that's better than working in a factory. And a lot of guys did that.
So it could be full-time work.
It
could be your job.
I mean, most of those guys had, you know, jobs in the off-season too, but it was, most of them made decent money comparatively as to what else was out there.
And what about the crowds? People turned out, right?
They drew good crowds. I mean, I think for, the numbers are not always recorded, but several hundred people for a game. And like the All-Star game I saw, you know, a couple thousand people for big All-Stars. So they did really well until the early 50s, then the minor leagues started tailing off all across the country.
Tell us about some of the big players. There's, was it Hank Nesselrode?
Hank Nesselrode was an interesting character. He was from West Virginia, and he was one of those guys who'd been a promising player before the war. He played a couple years. Then he was in the military for 4 years. And then at, like, the Battle of the Bulge, he got frostbite on his toes. And I guess he lost some toes. I don't know. He couldn't really run after that, but he could certainly swing a bat. I mean, he was a huge star in the league for 3 years. Never hit less than 350, had a lot of home runs. He was a great player. Then he just decided to retire and ended up running a gas station in Sanford for years after that.
There were some pros who made it to the – well, first of all, some of the big-time players who actually came through this league, right?
There were. I mean, there were a few guys who had, you know, played a little bit in the major leagues before the war. And there were a few guys who went on to play in the major leagues, not many. I mean, no one really noticeable. But probably the biggest name – associated with the league was Van Lingle Mungo, who was an all-star pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 30s. And he played probably 15 years in the major leagues. And after military service, I think he tried one more time at the major leagues, didn't make it. And he signed on with Clinton, North Carolina, as sort of the manager and player. He played part-time, then managed the team. And he was there for 2 years. So he was.
Were these players kind of hometown favorites, and were they big people in their town?
Some were. Some were real big. I mean, some of them were just guys like a lot of them were like local stars who just stayed around and you know, maybe played high school there. Some of them were just guys who just signed on for a job. They could have been from anywhere, and just Canada even, you know, just got a job. And then some of them, like Lumberton and Red Springs, were actually part of Major League Farm Systems. Red Springs was part of the Athletics, and Lumberton was part of the Cubs. And so those teams were a little bit different because those players were assigned there from who knows where. Yeah.
What were the crowds like? Were they big crowds? What would it have been like to go to a game during those
years? It would have been a big crowd, especially on weekend nights. And, I mean, this was the big social event in these towns. There was not much else going on, probably. There was no television, really, at that time. And this is where people went to chat and to meet their friends. And it was a big thing. Even if you didn't really pay attention to the game, you still would have gone just to, because that was a thing to do in the town.
It's Snow Hill, North Carolina, was not a part of the league that you write about, but you use that as a pretty good example of a team that...
Yeah, they were the smallest town in the country to have official professional baseball, and that was right before the war. And at that time, the town's population was like 700 people, but they would draw 500 to a game, you know, and that's almost everyone came. So.
And air conditioning, you said the lack of air conditioning probably played a big part in this.
I think so. People liked to be outside. I mean, they were used to the heat, and then in the 50s, air conditioning did come along, and TV came along, and people could watch the Yankees on TV even or something like that. And so that the minor leagues just started dying out a little bit for a couple different reasons.
What's that? Yeah, Crash Davis is also somebody who played in that.
He played in it when it was a semi-pro league right before the war, when he was a student at Duke. And there were a couple guys. Tommy Byrne was another one. He played at Wake Forest. And, you know, Crash Davis went straight to the major leagues after playing at Duke. Then he was in the military. And then he came back to Durham, which led to his fame with his name in the movie and everything.
And that relationship he had with Susan Sarandon.
Yeah.
Which you don't write about in the book, but it's a crazy story.
But I did talk to him. He passed away a few years ago, but I talked to him about his time there in the semi-pro, and he talked about how bad the lights were when he played in Sanford, and the team was owned by a guy who owned the brick factory, and it was just an interesting story.
Well, that was. Let's go back to those semi-pro, because that's a fascinating, just the economics of that, you know, in terms of how these teams made money, the fact that the team would own the contract, and selling those became a big business.
Well, even when it was semi-pro, it wasn't about the contracts. That was just guys you would hire sometimes just for a game or two, or it was the college players you would have. But after the war, when it became truly professional, a lot of these teams, the team owned the contract. So if you had a guy who ended up winning a lot of games, was a great pitcher, you could sell his contract, and that's how the team survived. You might sell it to a higher minor league team. You might sell it to, you know, the Yankees. Who knows? But those teams always had scouts watching these small minor leagues to see who they could find.
Now, did these leagues play like the Tobacco League that you write about? Did they then have championship games with other leagues?
They did sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes those exhibitions, like especially before the season, they would play exhibition games against maybe Durham or Raleigh or whoever. And then after the season, sometimes, I know a couple years, they would play like the Coastal Plain League, which was a neighboring league, which was like Kinston and Goldsboro and those towns. They would play like a series with those guys, unofficial, just to raise money and for the fans, I guess.
What about the memorabilia? I mean, again, here's a league that only lasted 5 years. I would imagine that the memorabilia from that would be choice and
there's
precious.
There's not much. Yeah. I mean, I've found a few programs and a few photos. I had someone ask me one time, he's like, why don't you have any action photos? And I was like, but they didn't take any. It was just like team photos. That was the main thing, so...
Guys spitting tobacco, you don't have any of those shots.
No, I don't.
A lot of statistics, though, if you're a stats fan, man.
Yeah, I added that because I thought it was important to record some of those guys, because some of those guys' stats are not anywhere else. And some of the ones, if you played less than 10 games, you're not officially recorded in the register. So I tried to find guys who just played a few games, put them in there, just so their names are always in there for their families. That's an interesting part when someone reads it. Oh, that's my grandfather, and I didn't know he did that. And that's really a rewarding thing.
Must have been an interesting universe, a world for pro scouts, I'm thinking, with all these leagues, because North Carolina is not alone. This is only one league in the state of North Carolina that you're writing about. If you're a pro scout, I would imagine leagues like this kept scouts pretty busy, huh?
I'm sure it did. There were lots more scouts than there are today because they had a big area to cover.
Well, then, and all you needed was now, as Billy Bean pointed out, you just need computers. You don't need scouts anymore.
Yes.
To make this thing work. Now, this was a segregated league, so this was an all-white league.
Yes, it was segregated. I mean, the professional baseball became desegregated officially in 1946 when Jackie Robinson played for Montreal. But segregation didn't reach North Carolina at all until 1951. And that year, New Bern was the first team to hire a few black players right at the end of the season. And then after that point, it slowly picked up. Willie McCovey's in the Hall of Fame, played for High Point a couple years later. So, but in this league, no, there was no segregation.
What about, were there, and we know that there were Negro leagues, was there any interplay between them and what was going on in these towns?
Not officially, but yeah. I think preseason. I don't know about this league, but yeah. I have seen instances where white teams would play black teams preseason exhibition games.
Right. So now there's some fascinating stories in here as well, including the riot that broke out in Wilmington.
That was a big fight. It was between Van Lingle-Mungo, who was manager of Clinton, and Gus Britton, who had also played in the major leagues a little bit with the Reds, who was manager of Winston-Salem. They got into a slugging match, and they both got fined. The town of Wilmington got fined, and it was even the president of the National Association said it was the worst fight he'd ever seen in professional baseball, and it was a big
what
mess.
And the beef was over a bad call.
It was just a bad call, I think. You know, yeah. And that things like that happen, and it's. Yeah. It was probably for the entertainment of the fans as much as anything. Probably.
Well, talk more about that, too, the way it's promoted. I mean, you think about NASCAR as kind of the shining light on the hill, if that's the way you want to look at it, in terms of being able to promote a sport and the idea of a sharp promoter is getting an idea that they've got a market out there, and if they can come up with the right angles, they can get a lot of people to buy this product. Any of that going on in this league, or was this just people wanted to play baseball? That was enough to get them out.
I think it was people wanted to play baseball, but it was also it was promoting a town as much as anything. Like mm-hmm. a lot of guys wanted to promote their own town, like Whiteville, for instance. The owner was the car dealership guy, and he owned the team, and he just wanted to say his town had its own professional yeah. team, I think, you know, and that was not uncommon. So it was sort of a pride thing, I think, just to sort of push their town.
And obviously in professional sports today, the idea that the people on your team are actually from your town is crazy, but how many of those players, or what percentage of the teams would have been made up of hometown
players? I would bet it's half. I mean, it varied a lot, especially with the two teams that were part of farm systems. Not many were local, but a lot of towns like Wilmington, for instance. I mean, there were guys who were on the team every year who were Wilmington natives, and they just wanted to play at home. And they might have been good enough to play elsewhere, but they just preferred to play at home. And
guys who had been players, how many players might have been in the majors and were on their way down?
Probably around 20, I bet. Like yeah. Gus Britton, the guy who was in the fight, he was from Wilmington, and he ended up coming back, and he was manager of Wilmington team, and he was still playing part time.
And a lot of great stories about, you know, again, the localness and the fact that the local community was engaged. To talk about one guy who married a girl at home plate.
He did, and he was from Pennsylvania, and he just, you know, he ended up meeting a girl from Smithfield, is where that was, and he just stayed in Smithfield the rest of his life. And that, I think that was not uncommon for people just to discover a new town and just like it and stay.
So only around for 5 years, in the immediate aftermath of World War II and then the next 5 years, what do you think caused his decline?
I think it was, well, the attendance was the main thing. It was the money. But I think the money was brought about by, you know, the TV and the air conditioning and other factors. And it's, I think maybe there was more going on. I think probably the years right after the war, it was just, like you said, a return to normalcy, or people mm-hmm. wanted something easy, just go watch the baseball game. And I think that's why it was so popular. 1948 was the high point of minor league baseball.
Is there a legacy? Is there a way that this sort of feeds into the larger story of baseball that followed?
I mean, I think that area has always been a hotbed for baseball. Southeastern North Carolina has always been big. I mean, just this year, the pitcher from Whiteville, Mackenzie Gore, was a number 3 draft in the whole country, went to the Padres. I mean, so they're still producing a lot of great baseball in this part of the state.
What about, and you talked about college players as well, once this, the initially the semi-pro team before the war made up largely of college players who wanted to stay busy during the offseason. Once it became a minor league, this sort of the tobacco league itself, many college players there?
There were a few who, you know, were out of college at that point who came and signed on. Like the manager of Sanford for the whole time, his name was Zeb Harrington. He had played at Elon, you know, back in the 30s, and he came and was in Sanford for all 5 years, I think. So there were some guys who just, again, probably wanted to play near home or just didn't think they had what it take to get. Because after the war, there were so many baseball players. It was a flood of baseball players. So your chances of advancing were pretty slim.
You think, I mean, minor league baseball is still pretty big in North Carolina today. Is there any place where we could go today that sort of looks like what it might have looked like back in the late 40s?
I would say Burlington, because Burlington is rookie league, so it's guys who are just out of high school or college and or from a foreign country, and they're playing with wooden bats for the first time, usually. And it's just very low-key, and it's a small park, and that's the one that reminds me the most of what this probably was like.
What was your biggest surprise in putting this book together?
Just, I think because finding out what some of these guys did after their baseball careers was really the interesting thing. I mean, because some of them, nowadays you think of baseball players just retiring and living off their money, but like these guys, probably the most interesting one was Don Carter, who was, he played 1 year of baseball total, you know, becoming a professional bowler. He was one of the biggest bowlers ever. He was the first athlete to sign a $1 million endorsement deal. And he just turned his back on baseball and took up bowling.
Yeah, strikes were still an important part of his career.
I guess
though,
so.
That's an important thing. Chris, thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you very much.
Chris Holliday is the author of The Tobacco State League, a North Carolina baseball history, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Tomorrow on The State of Things, another episode of Back Channel. We'll talk about the new movie Girls Trip. It's a hit comedy. We'll find out why it's so successful and about its lineage of movies. It's a part of that lineage of movies about sisterhood. That and the series Confederate, not even out yet and still stirring controversy. We'll talk about all that on Back Channel tomorrow on The State of Things, which is a program that is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.